is Midday on WNYC. I'm Arun Vanigopal. Omega-3s have been called an essential dietary supplement because we can't make them and because they're important components of our brains and our eyes. Some studies have shown that they can cut the risk of cardiovascular disease by 9 to 30%. Others that they can increase brain volume, boost sperm competitiveness, prevent some forms of depression and anxiety, and build muscle in older adults. There are also significant doubts about many of these claims from the medical establishment. Nonetheless, omega-3s are a multi-billion dollar industry. In his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet, Paul Greenberg explores the history of omega-3s and how we can eat an omega-3-rich diet that also somehow respects our planet. Hi, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Arun.
So what is this thing called the Omega Principle?
Well, when I set out to kind of cover the world and look at the omega-3 fatty acid, I was 47 at the time. So all these like middle-aged things were starting to affect me, stiff knees, high blood pressure, da-da-da. And so the omega-3 comes up in relation to all these middle-aged things. So on one level, the Omega Principle is a journey. It's a journey around the world and throughout medicine and throughout the environment to understand what do omega-3s actually do, and could we find a way through our eating habits, not just through supplements, to balance ourselves in an omega-3 direction?
And this is a big question because it's a lot of, I guess, economic interests that are really trying to, I guess, exploit this particular, you know, concern, such as what you as an individual have had.
Absolutely. I mean, I went to this omega-3 conference in the Canary Islands at the Ritz-Carlton, of all places.
Okay.
And I remember there was this woman who had done a big sort of survey of all of the omega-3 users that this one company was targeting. And she described this arc of life. And she targeted exactly the moment where I was at in the sort of mid to late 40s when you start to feel this decline. And she defined this period as the Indian summer of life, that in an ideal world, you hit 45 and you mitigate all of these declines. And somehow the Indian summer is beautiful and warm and temperate. And then maybe around like 85, 90, boom, you die and that's it. So that's the that's what the omega industry is selling to us. Whether or not it's true is really a large part of the book.
And there's a real price to be paid to maintain or to sort of renew people's lifestyle and to make them feel healthier and smarter and have larger, greater brain volume. A lot of people might just think of this as a pill that lands up in a bottle, but there's a lot of potentially destructive activity that goes into making that, doesn't
it? Yeah, well, so omega-3s are the product of what is called the reduction industry. And the reduction industry is actually a couple hundred years old, and it predates the discoveries of omega-3s by a couple centuries. And the first thing that we reduced were whales. 390,000 out of the 400,000 great whales in Antarctica were reduced, mostly for margarine and also nitroglycerin for bombs. It's kind of weird combination of things. Mm-hmm. But this sort of desire to take the natural world and boil it down to its elements is a very old tradition. The omega-3 thing right now, it's not from whales. I don't want, you know, you're not taking a whale supplement. But it's the same process. And instead of targeting whales, what we're targeting are what are called forage fish, things like anchovies and herring, essential fish that are the way that the solar energy from the sun hits the ocean. It gets converted into mass by plankton. Then these little fish eat the plankton, and then bigger fish eat the little fish. So if you remove those little fish from that food chain, suddenly there's no way for solar energy to get up to the big fish and get to us. So it's a really real, it's an invisible layer of life, but it's an essential layer of life. And we are taking out somewhere between 20 and 25 million tons of these little guys every single year. That's the human weight of the United States removed for fertilizer, for animal feed, and yes, omega-3 dietary supplements.
So this is like the new, the frontier, the sort of the new fad, if you will, that is really, I guess, prompting a lot of overfishing in some parts of the world.
Well, so omega-3s are part of it. So it's really the reduction industry. And most of the little fish that get ground up and boiled down are used for animal feed. At first, they were used for chickens. Then they were used for pets. Then now, most recently, a lot of animal feed, a lot of these little fish goes to feeding aquaculture, that is farmed fish. But then on top of it now, we have this omega-3 industry, which is sort of kind of like putting this sort of healthy sheen over the whole process. So somehow, we're not going to worry about what the salmon eat. We're not going to worry what the chickens eat. But there's this healthful product that actually comes from a base that involves extracting all of this marine life from the ocean.
So you're trying to, you've kind of inserted yourself into this ongoing debate, it seems, that you address early on in the book, which is the extent to which advances or leaps in human cognitive ability over the millennia, the extent to which they, those leaps were due to omega-3s or seafood in general.
Yeah, well, to me, the omega-3 is a really fascinating molecule. It's, I call it the Forrest Gump molecule because it sort of shows up everywhere just like Forrest Gump did. And if you look in human evolution, so we Homo sapiens appeared 300,000 years ago, more or less. For those first 270,000 years of our existence, we really didn't have much to show for it. You know, we killed some animals, we made some stone tools, et cetera, et cetera. But then around 270,000 years ago, we started to see what's called the cognitive revolution. And there is a lot of correlative evidence, not causal, but correlative, and that's a big difference, a big part of the book, that once we'd killed all the big land mammals and didn't have stuff to kill anymore, we started wading into the water and pulling up mussels and catching fish. And that was the sudden infusion of omega-3s from those fish that caused us then to develop agriculture, that caused us to develop complex languages, complex society, money. All of these things follow the mass ingestion of seafood. Now, I'm not saying that that's what happened. I wasn't there.
It's a theory.
It's a theory, and it's an interesting one. And that's, you know, that's the fun of the omega-3, is that you can follow really funny lines of research down every kind of avenue.
Talking to Paul Greenberg about his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. So these advances, they weren't, I guess, diffused around the world. They were happening in half a dozen or so places around the world, correct?
Yeah, yeah. We saw them in South America. You see them in the Mississippi Valley. You see them in the Fertile Crescent in Europe. You see them in India. And what's interesting to note is that each of these central centers where agriculture arose, where modern languages arose, were also areas with large estuaries and presumably large access to seafood. So I think it's kind of cool. But the other thing about that whole thing is that, and this happens throughout the book, is that our development of land-based agriculture actually ends up looping back and messing up the seafood. Because we, as we start to drain swamp land for agriculture, as we start to divert water away from estuaries, we're actually cutting off our nose to spite our face, so that we're creating all this land food that ends up actually causing us to be higher in calorie, higher in saturated fat, higher in all of these things that we shouldn't be eating, and lower in things like omega-3s. So, you know, that's another big loop in this, in the book.
So in this context, you, in trying to report this book, what exactly were you setting out to learn?
I think I was trying to understand, does the omega-3 work? You know, that was really essential part of it, because I mean, when I first started out on the project, nobody said anything bad about omega-3s, but literally just as I was putting pen to paper, all of these giant studies started coming out from Journal of American Medical Association, New England Journal of Medicine, showing absolutely zero effect of omega-3 supplements on cardiovascular disease in particular. So I tried to do this a few different ways. One thing I did as part of this research, for a year, I stopped eating land food meat entirely. Mm. And only ate seafood for every single breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
How much did you eat before that? Were you like a fan of chicken or beef or anything?
I mean, I did. I was an omnivore, and I probably already ate more fish than the average American, since I am a fisherman and I like to fish, and there was always fish in my freezer. I, on this diet, just went full out, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and I had my cholesterol, my triglycerides, my blood pressure, my heart rate all tested before I did that, and I had that done at the end.
And what were you eating? Were there particular fish and seafood that you were eating a lot?
Well, so at first, I was eating anything. And after, you know, about 6 months in, I was doing a story about mercury contamination. And I clipped my hair, which is, if you really want to get a true idea of what your mercury levels are, don't get a blood test. Get a hair test. Get a clip of your hair. Anyway, I was working with a scientist who had a mercury tester in his lab. And my mercury was off the charts. So I was very concerned that I think at one point I went to I was in Alaska and I was talking to this guy who measures mercury levels in Inuit people who eat a lot of seafood. And basically, when I told him what my mercury level was, he said, you know, if you had that level and it came into my lab, we would send somebody out to your village and tell you to stop eating so much whale blubber. Mm. So it was quite high. So then I backed off and I stopped eating tuna because mm-hmm. tuna is the largest form of a source of mercury.
Because it's also older tuna, bigger tuna? Is that what
they
say?
No, I mean, tuna are just highly, highly carnivorous. Mm. So they're higher up on the food chain and they do something called bioaccumulation. Mm. So the load of the mercury in every little fish that they eat is stored in the body of the tuna. And so they just keep eating more and more little fish and storing up. Incidentally, back to the omega-3 story, that's actually how omega-3s get into fish too. A lot of people think that omega-3s are made by fish, but they're not. Actually, omega-3s come from plankton,
right.
And they also bioaccumulate in fish. And so that's why some of the highest omega-3 fish are often higher up in the food chain, predatory, because they're getting the omega-3 benefit from all the little fish that they've eaten. There are exceptions to that, though.
So is part of the question, or is one of the questions, rather, why don't we just go ahead and eat the plankton rather than eating the fish that eat the plankton?
Yes, it's a big, big question. One of the things I kind of came to the conclusion was, I don't know if we necessarily have to go all the way down to the plankton. We can eat, though, a whole range of fish that are typically boiled down for supplements. Things like, for example, anchovies. The Peruvian anchovy, or anchoveta, as it's locally called, that's the most caught fish in the world. 10 million metric tons sometimes like an eighth of the entire world catch. Now it's probably more between 2 and 5, but it's a lot. And 99% of it, by law, gets boiled down into fertilizer, animal feed, and supplements. Only 1% gets eaten by humans. I've eaten them. I went to the one plant in Peru where they actually make or can anchovies for humans. They were so happy to see me. They gave me a 20-pound can of anchovies, and I hauled that sucker home. I mean, I got some very strange looks from TSA, brought it home, opened it up, and I will tell you, I ate every last ounce of that 20 pounds of anchovies.
And you just feel your brain volume exploding?
Oh, I mean, I had to, you know, get a, you know, an incision opened up because the brain was bulging.
No, just leaking out.
Yeah. No.
How alluring. So you also traveled to Italy, didn't you?
And I did.
I think there was a restaurant owner that you sat and had lunch, and
yep.
maybe even anchovies there too, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And he said something to you that was intriguing. He said, "This is what you do in America. You take something that is completely normal and good, but instead of just leaving it as it is, you try and make a business out of it. You take it and you make it into a trend." What did he mean by this?
Well, I think he was really pointing his finger at the omega-3 supplements. In Italy, and the reason I went to Italy was, well, you know, I had to go to the Amalfi Coast. It tortured me, but I had to go. But I really wanted to go to find out about the Mediterranean diet. And I really wanted to understand why it was in the Mediterranean. Historically, people eating the traditional Mediterranean diet were living 3 to 5 years longer than Americans, had much lower levels of cardiovascular disease and chronic disease. So I wanted to see that. And so what I came to understand in the Mediterranean was that there was this way of eating in which you had very little animal protein, you know, like a couple servings a week or something like that, large amounts of vegetables, large amounts of fruits, fair amount of olive oil. And I will say this, the animal protein that they did eat tended to be oily fish. So that kind of led me in this direction of thinking of kind of a new diet. You know, there's the Mediterranean diet, but after all this research and talking to all these people, I realized that the best diet we could probably eat would be something I call the pescaterranean diet, which is a Mediterranean diet with just a little bit of animal protein, but that animal protein that's coming to us are small oily fish like anchovies, bivalves like clams, oysters, and mussels, a lot of vegetables, a lot of fruit, and a lot of fiber, and probably that's your best shot at living a long and healthy life.
This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Arun Vanigopal, and I'm talking to Paul Greenberg about his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. So, Paul, you're hanging out in somewhere in the Mediterranean.
The Amalfi Coast, Chitara.
That's right. You're struggling with life in the Amalfi Coast. And you think that basically if we reduce our animal protein, our consumption of animal protein, eat more fish like they're having. What kind of fish are these again?
Anchovies, sardinella, some mackerel, lots of oily fish. Fish they call pesce azzurra, a blue fish, but not actually blue fish, but fish of an oily character. characteristic.
So the people who live here, they tend to live a little longer.
Yep.
They seem to be healthier in general.
Yep.
But there's also some question as to whether it is the reduction in animal protein and the increase of anchovies and the like, or if it's there's a weed that some people think might be at the heart of their lifestyle.
Yeah, well, that's called purslane. And I will say that, yes, just to remember, with all dietary studies, any diet that you look at, it's very, very hard to figure out what the heck is going on, what really truly works. But purslane's a classic example. So one of the characters in the book is a Greek clinician named Artemis Simopoulos. I just love saying that name, Artemis Simopoulos. Say that 20 times fast. But anyway, so she observed when she was back home in the summertime, she lives in America, she was back home in Greece. She noticed that the chickens there were all eating purslane. And she noticed that when she looked at an egg from one of these chickens, it was much brighter orange. It tasted different. So she smuggled some eggs back to the National Institutes of Health. And she, along with this guy named Norm Salem, they looked at the omega-3 quality in the eggs. And they found that eggs that came from the Mediterranean had an omega-3 level much, much higher and an omega-6 level much, much lower.
It's like a 2-to-1 ratio,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, yeah. And so in America, meanwhile, it's more like 15-to-1 omega-6 to omega-3. Why is this important? Well, it turns out that omega-6s and omega-3s, they occur in the American diet in different places. But it turns out that omega-3s and omega-6s actually compete with one another to elongate short-form omega-3s, ALA, short chain. I'm going to, I can see your eyes glazing over as we, but they basically, omega-3s lead us to resolution. Omega-6s tend to lead us to inflammation. And so—
What is resolution?
Well, just the opposite of inflammation, to okay. quieting of inflammation.
Got it.
So, when we eat a lot of omega-6s, and omega-6s are coming to us from soy oil, from corn oil, from all these sort of industrial modern foods, it seems to block the body's ability to take vegetable sources of omega-3s and transform them into the long chain form that helps us with resolution and all these other health benefits. So it could be. It's not just the fish that help get more omega-3s into our body. It's that if we're eating a lot of corn and soy and processed foods, that we're actually not able to synthesize omega-3s naturally from the vegetable sources that we might be getting. So it makes you realize that there's not just a supplement that has to be taken. It's that we have to lean our diets in the direction of omega-3s and away from omega-6s. What does that mean? Well, again, that's the pescatarian diet. You want to have a lot of leafy greens, a lot of fruits and vegetables, stay away from oils which have an omega-6 profile. You want, you know, so lean more towards monounsaturated fats like olive oil, and stay away from corn and grain-fed beef and things like that.
So purslane, which I actually had a purslane salad yesterday.
Yeah.
My wife got some at the farmer's market,
yep.
and I'd never heard of it. And
yep.
I was like, wait, I have heard of it.
In the Omega Principle.
That's right. Paul Greenberg's book.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was delicious salad, and yet I guess some people think it's just some random weed that's lying around on the Amalfi Coast.
That's right. Well, there are a lot of leafy, dark green vegetables like purslane, like spinach, that have these short-chain omega-3s in them. Did you get any benefit from the purslane? Well, I'd have to look at your whole diet.
But do I sound a little smarter?
Oh, well, totally. I mean, you know, I've heard you on the radio before, but this is unbelievable. There's a people can't see the glow, the purslanic glow coming off your
the
skin.
The levitation.
The levitation. We're actually levitating as we speak. But no. I'd have to look at, or I'd have to have a clinician look at your whole diet to understand, like, okay, so you're getting some short-chain omega-3s from vegetable sources, but are you also loading up on, you know, corn, you know, popcorn fried in soy oil, or, you know, what else? What is the whole thing? So that's what led me to believe, I mean, there's people who challenge the idea of omega-3 versus omega-6s, but generally speaking, and this is a big through line in the book, is that there are two food systems out there. There's an omega-6 system, which involves feedlot animals, corn and soy, degradation of marine waterways. And then there's an omega-3 system, which involves seafood, which involves leafy greens, which involves small farms. And whether or not you believe in omega-3 versus omega-6, it occurs to me that, and seems to me very strongly, that an omega-3 world would be healthier for us and healthier for the planet.
I'm talking to Paul Greenberg about his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. So we've been talking about the long life aspect a fair bit. But the healthier planet aspect, You're saying that if we get away from the land-based proteins and toward more of a seafood-oriented diet, it would be better for us. But as you've described in your book, the means by which we acquire these omega-3s in seafood is also really destructive, isn't it?
It can be. It can be. I mean, the way we have set up marine farming, for example, aquaculture, we're more or less emulating what we've done on land. So if you look at, say, the diet of a modern salmon right now, it's, again, soy. It's wild fish harvested and killed and boiled down and put into these pellets. But what I found in the course of the book, that there was a way to grow seafood without these kind of harmful effects. First of all, we could look at what we grow. We could grow mussels. We could grow clams. We could grow oysters, which, by the way, high in omega-3s. Mm. Those creatures, you don't have to feed them anything. They live off of filtering microalgae, which, remember, are the very things that invented the omega-3 fatty acid in the first place. So we could grow clams, mussels, oysters, all kinds of kelp and seaweed that have very low carbon footprints, no freshwater use, nothing at all. So manna from heaven, practically. If we still wanted to eat fin fish and grow fin fish, it turns out there's actually a way that we could feed them which wouldn't involve destroying a lot of marine wildlife. One of the most exciting things, believe it or not, that I found in this book was something called the black soldier fly larva. And what these creatures do is you can grab a bunch of them, put them on food waste, and they gobble it up, the soldier flies gobble it up, and then the meal that you can make from those black soldier flies is 98% as nutritious as Peruvian anchoveta. So you could feed it to all the salmon in the world and have this completely closed loop, eliminating waste and getting more fish on our plates.
Aside from things like purslane, there other vegetable sources for omega-3?
Spinach is quite good. A lot of the dark leafy greens tend to be good. Avocados are pretty good. But again, it's important to remember that these are short-chain ALA, alpha-linolenic acid, that need to be elongated into the longer chain, the EPA and the DHA, to become truly useful to our bodies. Of course, there's tons of research. One of the things I found in this book is that every compound has their promoters. You know, and I think I loosely call everyone around omega-3s, I call it Omega World. You know, and it's this series of clinicians, dietitians, and they all just support their product exclusive to all these other things that could be having a health effect on us. But getting back to your question, the good thing about a lot of the ALA, the short-chain omega-3 fatty acid foods, avocados, spinach, leafy greens, those are good for you anyway, right? It's a lot of fiber. So I always think that, you know, like Michael Pollan, who warned us about nutritionism, you know, about focusing too much on things like vitamins and minerals and not thinking about the very complex package that food actually is, I would rather see omega-3s be perceived as kind of a marker of good food, because many of the good foods that are healthy for us tend to be high in omega-3s and tend to lead in that direction.
But when you paint this picture of how these omega-3s are procured, I can't remember the name of it, but there's certain kind of boats you talk about that go out there and they engulf.
Purse seiners, they're called. Because they literally form a purse around a school of fish, like a hoard of coins, and put it in their purse and haul them away and take them up. Listen, there are major problems in all of our food systems. And the major problem here is this desire and this idea that we can somehow reduce wildlife into an essential nutrient and not worry about the effect that it has throughout the ecosystem. So what I'm proposing is really a food system where we get rid of reductionism, as I call it. Like the reduction industry, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. But I think, as I ask in the book, you know, is this really befitting of 21st century humans that we're using technology really from the age of Herman Melville? Like, we have all these other ways of getting omega-3s, and why are we still doing this?
So for someone who's trying to put their energy into a better lifestyle, but also into a healthier planet, what advice do you have?
Well, so I would focus, first of all, cut your animal protein down significantly. Try to get it down to a couple, three meals a week. I advocate for the pescatarian model, so try to have those meals be fish if you can. But think about the fish. Why not one meal a week of clams, mussels, or oysters, which again are very low impact? The other meal could be these pesce azzurra, these small forage fish like anchovies and herring. And I see your brow furrowing slightly when I'm saying to eat the very fish that are also being used by the reduction industry. My feeling is if that we got rid of the reduction industry and instead we just ate those fish, that we could catch half the fish and they could sell for twice the price because they're no longer just some industrial product. They're food for humans. So I don't want to put the fishermen out of business. I would like them to keep on fishing, but I'd just like them to cut the catch down to a level that humans need, not for some supplement company or for, you know, an animal feed company.
In your travels, though, you notice that a lot of these fishermen are actually losing their business considerably because of this massive overfishing.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in the Mediterranean, because the Mediterranean is like the most overfished sea probably in the world. There's more than 23 nations surrounding it. And so they're all competing for the same fish, and they're really bleeding it dry. So the Mediterranean, well, it looks beautiful, and I love to go to the Mediterranean. We love that azure water. It is really, really seriously compromised by overfishing at this point.
And you refer to it as, I guess, the tragedy of the commons sort of writ large.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Mediterranean was the first commons. You know, it was the sea between the lands is literally what it means. And it's this place. And it's very hard. You know, one of the problems with wild fish, particularly migratory fish, is that it's very hard to say, it's like, this is my fish and this is your fish and we'll split this up. People in the Mediterranean are sort of like, I got to get my fish before he gets my fish trapped from under me. So that's part of the problem. But I think there's a much larger picture than this, than just sort of simply fighting over what wild fish we're going to take. I do believe there's a place for wild fisheries in the world. We can continue to harvest fish if we do it in a sustainable way. But I personally think if we left 20 million metric tons of fish that right now go into fertilizer factories and supplement factories and animal feed factories, if we left 20 million metric tons of fish in the world in the water, wouldn't that mean much more bigger fish that we like to eat? Wouldn't it mean more whales? Wouldn't it mean more seals? Wouldn't it mean a more powerful ocean? I think it would. And I think that that's a really essential question. I mean, I should say, I've met the supplement company people. They're not evil. They're very nice. And they all, each one has an argument for why their fishery is sustainable. And certainly there are a lot of scientists working on these questions. But the question they never ask is, what about the whole thing, the whole reduction industry? Do we need it? Could we work some other method for getting fish on our plate?
Does this require cooperation between hundreds of countries?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think what it requires is the elimination of the reduction market. Because the idea that there's this market out there, this for reduced stuff, for fish meal and fish oil, means that it's like an open door for stuff to come in from around the world. And I don't know if you've ever had the people from the Associated Press on the air who did the big seafood slavery stories that broke over the last few years. But there's huge amount of slavery going on in East Asia, and a lot of it are on vessels that are catching these little fish to be ground up for animal feed and for fertilizer, and probably some of it going to supplements as well. So because there's this market for this stuff from the ocean, it leaves this back door open for all sorts of bad behavior. I mean, there's good actors out there. Certainly the guys in Peru have really improved how they manage their fish, but there's the fact that there's a market means that there's an open door for bad behavior from other countries which aren't as well regulated.
Are there certain markers when people are shopping, say, for seafood, that they should be looking for packaging that actually you think is trustworthy versus stuff that's just bogus?
Well, you know, I believe that there are some supermarkets, for example, that are better with traceability. There's a report called Carting Away the Oceans that Greenpeace does where they rank supermarkets. If you look at it online, I think it's by its abbreviation CATO, C-A-T-O, Carting Away the Oceans. Google that and you'll see the ranking of supermarkets in their overall sustainability practices. Beyond that, though, there are some sort of interesting tweaks you could do. If you're ever buying anchovies, for example, look for anchovies that are product of Peru. Because, as I said, 99% of the Peruvian anchoveta goes into animal feed and supplements and so forth. But there is a tiny, tiny artisan industry, 1%, that is making anchovies for human consumption. I'd like to see that sector grow so that we can kind of help build up this idea of anchovies as food and not just as a chemical ingredient in something. I always advocate for bivalves, mussels, clams, oysters. almost always a good choice. The other big fish that I advocate for is the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon. Why? Well, it's the largest wild salmon run left in the United States. Right now, the Trump administration has reversed an Obama-era decision to stop a copper mine that was going to be put on top of it. So Obama's effectively stopped that. Pruitt, bye-bye. Relaunched it, settled with the company that had sued EPA. And as we speak, the Army Corps of Engineers is starting the permitting process to put this giant copper mine on top of the largest sockeye salmon run in the world. So I always say, go to the store, buy some sockeye salmon. Chances are it's coming from Bristol Bay. And it's kind of like a finger in the eye of the people who are saying, nah, we'd rather have a big polluting copper mine on top of this. So sockeye salmon, anchovies from Peru, clams, mussels, oysters, that'll get you through a good chunk of your month.
Have you been noticing any changes in yourself since you've changed your lifestyle and diet?
Well, so when I went on the seafood diet, you know, fish every day for a year and every meal, I actually did have high mercury levels, and I backed off that since then. Now, as I say, I'm eating this pescatarian diet, a couple of seafood meals a week, but I've also reduced my calories quite a bit. I was having lunch with Marian Nessel, who you might have had on the show before, who's a great professor at NYU and has done all these things about food politics. And, you know, her advice is like, eat what you want, but not so much. When they do the Mediterranean diet studies, or when they did the Mediterranean diet studies and looked at the people of Crete, for example, who were living much longer, one of the main takeaways that doesn't get reported that much is that they were exercising a lot and they weren't eating that much. One of the subjects from a 1948 Crete study said, mostly we're hungry all the time. So unfortunately, I don't like to be hungry, but its calories are
maybe
really
the right choice.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Arun. It was really fun.
I'm Arun Vanigopal, and I've been speaking with Paul Greenberg about his book published by Penguin Press, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet.